Paul Richardson coming to you from Southeast Asia. I'm here with my good friend, one of my best friends, Mike O'Quinn. And Mike, you and I have been out here living on the front lines here, working side by side and serving the Lord for a lot of years. And you've had a great impact on my life. It's been, just been so fun doing these podcasts together and just sitting, having conversations.
Thanks,
Paul. Of course, for you and me, we have these conversations all the time, and so it's just sort of fun to get a microphone and record it and maybe share it with some others. But one thing I've noticed about you, Mike, that really stands out to me, one of the things I admire about you, among many things, is that you are an avid reader. And I don't know how you do that, because you seem so busy. You've always got a full schedule. You've always got things you're working on. You know, you're writing right now. You're raising 4 children. You're an amazing husband for your wife. You're always, you know, you're taking your kids out. What was it, yesterday? 2 days ago, I was riding my bike out in the middle of nowhere, and then I just came across you out in your car. You're stuck in the mud going off. You're going four-wheeling, but without a four-wheel drive.
I was going in the mud because I didn't listen to my wife, who said, "No, we cannot make it across that mud embankment." And I said, "Yes, we can." She said, "No, we can't." So she won that argument.
So what? How many hours were you stuck there?
Well, after 1 hour of digging around the wheelbase with my bare hands, finally some people came to rescue me and to laugh at me and to bring a shovel. I think they came to your garage and got your shovel, actually.
Well, when I saw you, I almost didn't recognize you. You're so covered with mud. But there you are out there with your family, you know, doing a family day.
Stuck in the mud.
And yet somehow we have these conversations, you know, and different topics come up, and then you just start talking about one book after another that you've read, and you just, you're one of those people that is very, very well read. And so I want to just try to tap into that a little bit and just share with us, before we start talking about some of your favorite books and things like that, but tell me why it is you love to read, first of all.
Sure. Well, thanks, Paul. Thank you for your compliment. I'm almost wanting to deflect it and put it back on you and say, you're a great reader. You're a wonderful person. But I will say, I've heard this quote a long time ago from my pastor, Ron Parrish, who was quoting some professor, I think, who said, a leader is a reader. Uh-huh. You know, and I think as leaders, we have to stay fresh. Hmm. We can't be just taking yesterday's manna and giving it to the masses, but we need to have fresh input in our souls. And that struck me as, you know, a book is the best way to do that, because someone else has already thought through a concept, they've wrestled with it, and you know yourself, the process of writing, just how refining it is to get through an idea and really think it through. And they've done all the hard work, and then they give it to us for you know, $10. Uh-huh. And then we can benefit. We can stand on the shoulders of giants. Hmm. So to me, it's just a no-brainer as far as learning life lessons, what people have learned, to be able to just ransack what they've learned. It's just a great way to get ahead, to feel like you're learning from people who've gone through different struggles and really wrestled through things. And so yeah, I really enjoy it. You know, to me, give me a $100 gift certificate to Amazon.com and I'm a happy camper. You know, I could go to town on that. I've got a running wish list. Uh-huh. You know, my mom, I talked to my mom this morning and she went to my wish list and got me a few books.
Interesting.
I was like, yes.
So how do you find good books to read? What's your method of searching for your next book on your book pile?
Probably word of mouth, you know.
Really?
Asking people, hearing someone talk about a book that they've read, or a book that's been quoted, or a book that's a bestseller, you know. And sometimes I'm not even interested. I might not be interested in the subject, but if millions of people are reading this book, there's got to be a reason. Uh-huh. So even if I'm not, like, I might not be dealing with that particular issue, just reading it, and usually I discover, wow, this person has a lot to say on this subject. When I'm talking about, I'm not talking about novels, but I'm talking about nonfiction, you know, reading books that are more like teaching-oriented books.
One thing I've noticed about your reading habits is that you read in a lot of different genres, and that really impresses me, because I pretty much stick with history, with biographies, with business, and with leadership, and pretty much anything beyond that, you know, it's pretty hard for me to go near it, like purpose-driven life, you know. One of the best, what is it, the top-selling book in the century?
Top-selling hardback of all time.
I won't go near that book, but of course you've read
Rick
it.
Rick Warren,
read,
if you're listening, please forgive us.
Just about any book I've ever heard of, you've read it, you know, and so you recommend to me, you know, hey, read this Winston Churchill, you know, biography, and then the next thing, it's something by a pastor that you read, and... You know, so there's just a lot, and I see that. I see how that makes you. First of all, it makes you a very interesting person, because it helps you to be a person that can engage and interact with a lot of different topics and different kinds of people, different age groups, and you have something to bring to the conversation. You know, and that I really admire that. You know, for me, when I get in certain zones, certain conversations, I really. Just sort of melt into the wall, because I don't have much to give. You know?
Something I as you say that, I think of a quote from Bill Gates, who he said if he picks up a Time or Newsweek, he's immediately drawn to the business and technology sections, but he forces himself to read the whole thing cover to cover, so that he can stretch in areas that he's not interested in and he's not expertise in. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, that just challenges me, like, yeah, let's go beyond our narrow sphere of influence.
Yeah. Want to take that call there, Mike?
Why don't you keep talking and I'll take this call?
Well, let me, are you going to take it?
I'll pick it up. I'll
There's
pick it
300
up in a
people out there waiting for us right now.
They're hanging on the edge of their seats.
Good. No, go ahead. Just tell us what book you've read recently that has really spoken to your... I want to hear about books that have done more than just made you think, but that have actually touched the way you live.
Okay, and then I'll ask you the same question. Is
okay,
that fair?
Sure.
Well, high on top of that list, there's this book out... I saw it on Amazon.com. It's only $12.99. It's called A Certain Risk, Living Your Faith at the Edge.
All right. All joking aside.
Seriously, that did. I will put that book in a paradigm-shifting category. I like books that shift my paradigm, or as they say in Indonesia, paradigm.
Okay, you got my attention here. I'm gonna fish a little bit, because I got a pretty low self-esteem lately. So, tell us about this book, Mike. How did it shift your paradigm?
That's right. It's paradigm. I will. That's why I liked your book, because it reached that threshold of paradigm changing, and I'll share some other books. But I will say that my wife continues to call, so I better pick this up.
Hey, you got to make her
keep
the priority.
Rambling.
I'm not the kind of guy that can ramble.
Okay, so...
So because of my inability to improvise, we just hit pause there. So you take that phone call.
Okay, so we'll start with your book. There's a couple of concepts in there that have stayed with me. And that to me, that passes some threshold of you read a good book, and it's interesting, it's entertaining, and then it's forgettable. You know, it doesn't really change you for the long haul. There's a couple of concepts in there. One is you talk about improv art of the resistance that God wants in our life that activates us to the highest level of engaging with the world. The difference between kicking a ball into an empty soccer net and kicking a ball into the net with a fierce goalie staring you down at the World Cup finals, and that we're meant to encounter resistance, And the highest level of art is improv art, where you're making things up and there's a resistance. So just giving me a framework of understanding resistance and struggle, things not coming easy, instead of just whining and going to self-pity, of just saying, this is God ordained. Just like when you work out, you need resistance. That the resistance actually is bringing me to a higher level of my art form. The other concept that stood out was just about innovation. And you talk about, there's already the cure for AIDS is somewhere in the world. People just haven't thought hard enough about it. They haven't. The cure for cancer. So even this morning, like I was telling my children about the BP oil spill at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 1 mile down, just gushing out 15,000 barrels of oil, crude oil a day, which is, you know, it's going to affect my parents' life. They live on the Gulf of Mexico. So I was explaining it to my kids, and I told them, okay, when I come home, and I said this in jest, but they probably weren't sure if I was joking or not. I said, when I get home, I want you guys to draw up the schematics of solving this problem, because there is a way to solve this problem of these 15,000 barrels of oil coming out of this hole. So I showed them online. There's a, like a live cam, a streaming video that shows the oil spill. And I said, okay, what's your idea? And Jordan said, he's nine, build a wall. I say, okay, what kind of a wall? And then Caleb's like, I don't know, just ask, you know, that's not my job. That's for scientists. And someone else said, just ask Jesus to do it. But I want my kids to just, like, when they see a problem, to kind of lean into it, to think critically, to think creatively. Mm-hmm. How could I solve this problem? Now, and I told them, now look, you guys, when I come home, I need those schematics. You need to write a diagram, and I'm going to fax it to BP. You're going to be the most famous kids on the planet if you can figure out. I told them all the things that BP has tried that have failed. I don't want my kids to look at the world as they're watching a movie, eating popcorn, in one of your analogies, and that someone else will clean it up. But I want them to engage in the world's problems, just to start leaning into poverty, illiteracy, teen pregnancy, AIDS, for their heart to go toward problems and to be innovators and to be activators of change. So I want that value, and I really pick that up strongly in your book. And, you know, just a few lines, like about, I think you wrote, I don't know if I made it in the final edit, but about being a heat-seeking missile toward a problem. Like, when we look at problems, we don't just kind of shrug and say, what a pity. But something in us activates that we want to move toward problems to solve them. And I want my kids to be engaged and activated in the world. I don't want them to just sit behind a screen and just entertain themselves. I want them to engage the world's problems. So I got that out of your book, you know, and that was paradigm shifting. And very challenging at a core level. So that's one reason why I'm such a big fan.
So what else? What I hear you quoting a lot from Bill Johnson.
Yeah.
Is it Bill Johnson?
Yeah.
Tell us about his...
well, he's got some books out.
One book you've read, or how many?
I've read one book, and I've got another one that a lot of people have recommended. And he is a pastor in Redding, California. And there's a real grace in his life. He's a really excellent Bible teacher, so he goes into the Old Testament. And what I like is that there's such a emphasis on hope, on the best days are to come, of not like, as Christians, we're just kind of in this holding tank. We're ready to get raptured out of here, and we're just kind of biding our time. And like, instead of looking back, wouldn't it be great if we could go back to the 1950s and everyone went to church, and let's take back America? I've never been really like, we want to reclaim our roots. That's never really done a lot for me, honestly. Looking backwards, saying, to me, I want to go beyond wherever our founding fathers were spiritually, you know. I'm looking forward.
I love that.
And so when someone says, he's got this great quote, he says, hope is the joyful expectation of the good. So this sense of good things are coming down the road. And so he talks a lot about that. He's got a lot of stories, a lot of testimonies. So something, when I hear someone talking about the joyful expectation of the good, just something in me rises up, and it like gives words to this longing I have of this forward-looking faith that God is alive and well, that we can be a part of what he's doing, and we can believe him for bigger things. So So probably 80% of his sermons are around that theme. And so, and his books are very challenging and stretching because they're believing God to do financial miracles in their town. They've seen God do amazing miracles in people's bodies. Just that sense of God is here. He's with us. He's not endlessly contemplating himself somewhere up on the hill somewhere, but he's involved in our lives. So I connect with him. So I probably listen to his podcast about every other week, just to kind of, because I need to get a fresh injection. Because as you know, we live here. We're in the minority, world's largest Muslim nation. And we need, you know, we hear the call of prayer going off every morning, and it can feel like nothing ever changes. Right. You can kind of live under that blanket of unbelief. And to just get some fresh input of, no, God is on the move, is very, very faith-stirring and stretching for me.
Okay. So what would you say maybe top three, what are the top three most influential, powerful books, you know, that you've ever picked up?
Wow, that's a hard one. Let me give a category. Let me, because there's some books that have stirred me. There's some books that have changed me and motivated me, and there's some books that have shifted my paradigm. Which one you want to talk about?
Let's go with the second one. I want to hear about books that have changed your paradigm and affected your life, your life's direction.
Okay. There's classics, and I want to ask you the same, but I'll throw one out that I was actually thumbing through this morning, because it's so good. It stays on my bookshelf. It's Stephen Covey, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Okay.
And he talks about character. The main concept in that is that there are skills that you can learn to be more effective, but that are divorced from character. You can learn how to manipulate people and get things done, you know, and a lot of books. And what he discovered was a lot of books on leadership and management were about technique.
Interesting.
And they weren't about character. So he wrote a book about your character, keeping first things first. And it's such, I mean, you know, some people go, well, you know, I don't know, does this guy really know the Lord? And there's no Holy Spirit in this book. But, you know, if you just take it, you have to take a book for what it is. One book's not going to meet all your needs.
Yeah.
But if you just want to know, like, how to have a centered life, and he, you know, one concept he talks about is doing things that he calls quadrant two that are not urgent, but they're important. Mm-hmm. So anything that you're doing that's like a spiritual discipline, or you're trying to invest something into your children, nothing that is, no one's going to die if you don't do it. It's not urgent, but it's really important that people who are the most effective focus their energies on that quadrant two. And so that one concept, so I will think about that, like, okay, like, so this morning I spent about 45 minutes working on my manuscript, and it was like quadrant, you know, no one's asking me to do that, but it's quadrant two. It's important, and it's not urgent. So that book, and it was a multi-million, you know, copy bestseller back in the 80s, I guess. Was it 90s? Came out early 90s?
I think so.
And you have to read it with, this is an effective life, you know, and yes, I need the power of God, but just like a centered life, living out of your values. You know, there's great concepts about being an empathetic listener, not a sympathetic, but empathetic, where you really try to understand what other people are saying before, you know, you seek to understand before you seek to be understood. I mean, I think that book probably needs to be read every, you know, 3 or 4 years of my life, because it's just so core basic. So that's at the top of the list.
Yeah.
How about you? What's a book that's impacted you, changed you?
Oh.
Your paradigm.
In what paradigm?
Yeah. You read it and you were like, you put it down and said, whoa, I get it now. I'm a different person.
Interesting. Boy, where do I go there? I would say, one book that jumps out to me is Good to Great, another huge bestseller. And there's a reason why books are bestsellers, because they really touch people's lives. I mean, they really change how a lot of people think, and they're so well written. But Good to Great.
By Jim Collins.
By Jim Collins. I think the main thing that stood out to me in that was just how he described how these outstanding leaders, the best of the best leaders in the corporate world, are extremely humble people, genuinely humble people. And he found this in his research over and over and over again, that the most successful leaders were defined by their humility. And anytime, as an interviewer, anytime his questions, you know, how did you do this? How did you accomplish this success? What are your secrets? These leaders would always say, well, it wasn't me. I have all these amazing people working for me. And they would immediately bounce the question, you know, and just start honoring someone else. But then that humility was also combined with a zeal and a passion and a doggedness, a hard work, you know, where these people get to work early, they leave late. And there's just this, there's this intensity about their lives, which normally doesn't go with humility. Normally, this intensity of life is combined with arrogance, especially in the business world. And humility, I don't know why, but in a lot of people, humility is combined with laziness and lack of ambition. But then when you sort of reverse and you grab humility and you the chemistry is there when you put it in together, humility and ambition, highly driven people. And I like that. That speaks to me, and I have a high respect for people who work hard, who are excellent at what they do, you know, who show up early and leave late. I like that. That inspires me. And there's something in the business world or in any field, in sports or whatever it is, there are these certain people who just work harder and they're far more dedicated to what they do. And in my own field, in my work, there's actually not a lot of evaluation of excellence, mm-hmm. you know, in our field. It's sort of hands off, you know, when people talk about people in our line of work, there's very little criticism. And so I just love the idea of holding myself to a higher standard and keeping myself to the standard that anyone in any other field would have for themselves, but yet having humility at the same time. So that was a big book that in many ways sort of set me free, mm-hmm. And taught me so much about what real leadership means. You know, interesting, not a Christian book, but yet impacted me spiritually.
Yeah, I felt that too when I read that. Another concept out of that book was that he found it wasn't the charismatic leader. Uh-huh. It wasn't the someone that you think, wow, that person just has it all together. But it was really just the character of that person, just the base, like hardworking, mm-hmm. open to new ideas, open to correction, open to mid-course changes. And so that book went from how a good organization went to great. He wrote a book before that called Built to Last, uh-huh. which was basically how to start from scratch. Have you read that one?
I haven't read that one. No.
That I would really recommend that one too, because there was one concept in that book that I found very helpful. Is he talked about to these really great organizations built to the ones that, and he looked at ones that lasted for 100 years that have been really great organizations for like 100 years plus. So not uh-huh. not a flash in the pan, big, some internet startup that mm-hmm. was all the rage for 5 years, mm-hmm. but 100 years. And what he found is that they had a core set of values that never changed. For example, and I hope I'm getting all this right, but Sony wanted Japan to be synonymous with great products. Huh. That was their goal. Now, how you reach your core values is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. So, your value is that. So, Sony made these little toaster, these little heating pads that could toast bread. That was their first product. Mm-hmm. And then they switched to more radio components, and then the Sony Walkman came out. Mm. And then they kept changing. But their core value is we want people to, when they think Japan, they think high quality product. But that's constantly changed. So for my own little company that we've started here, I've shared that concept with our staff that we might not always be making PowerPoint presentations. Our vision is to empower the poor through excellence in business. And so if we find something that does that better than PowerPoint presentations, we'll ditch PowerPoint presentations.
I love
our
it.
Goal is not that. But what is our core value? Our core
so that idea was rooted in a book you read.
It was rooted in a book. And I couldn't put that book down. I mean, it's such a great book. And it's one of those books that I read at the right time. You know, here I am. I'm first time, no business experience, trying to start a company. And reading this book and just drinking it in so deeply, think, oh, I'm so thankful I know this. And it gave me some handrails. So I would recommend that book. And then actually Jim Collins wrote, and I'll let you borrow this, a little like addendum book to Good to Great called Good to Great for the Social Sector. And that's really interesting. So he looked at a good organization and a great organization in the social sector, and then compared those side by side. So, I mean, this is a guy who...
That's fascinating because it's a whole different animal being a leader in the social sector because you don't have...
Profit and loss statements. And
finances to motivate people.
Right. Yeah. So I would... And it's a short little book, but I'll let you borrow that, Paul. It's really interesting.
I'd love to see that.
And so, yeah. I mean, wouldn't you love just to sit by Jim Collins on like a long plane ride and just like ask him 100 questions?
He'd probably hate it, though.
Well, so there's people who are experts in their field who have just gone deep, deep, deep into the cave of knowledge, you know, and they found all these treasures.
It's amazing how people find this stuff.
We can just, you know, $10-$12, you know, we can get all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
It really is. It really is.
Well, how about you, Paul? What are some other books that got in there and after you read it, you were like a different person or changed your outlook?
The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell, was a big book for me. And he just, you know, he launches the book with this little story about Hush Puppy shoes, which were really popular, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. And then they almost completely died as a company. They just shriveled down until they were almost nothing. And then suddenly Hush Puppy shoes exploded, and without one commercial, without even spending $1 on promotions, suddenly Hush Puppy shoes had spread all across America and was selling millions, you know, millions and millions of dollars again. And so someone did some research and found that that there was this very popular nightclub in New York where these people were getting out on the dance floor and were dancing in Hush Puppy shoes. And it just, you know, the influence and just how this phenomenon, this movement, you know, moved from one person to another naturally without any gimmicks or anything like that, but just the power of human influence. And so the book talks about how certain people have immense influence and some people are connectors and they have knowledge. And, you know, there's these certain people like, in our town, there's a guy named Joe Kirk, you know, and I see him at the gym sometimes and we just talk and he always has a tip for me. Oh, every single time I see him, he's like, hey, you got to try this new restaurant. He'll say, hey, there's a great steak at this one restaurant and it's the lowest price. You got to try it out. And I always do. And he's always right, you know, so I trust him. And so he's one of these mavens that Gladwell describes in his book that hundreds of people begin to listen carefully to what this person says. And so if you're interested in launching any sort of a movement, then you have to find these mavens. And if you can influence one of them, it's worth more than influencing 1,000 people, you know, who don't have this influence.
Wow.
It plays with your mind a little bit and affects us with me, you know, how I think about ministry and strategically thinking how I spend my time with people. And since reading that book, I'm always asking this question, how can I multiply my influence and the time that I have so that it's strategically spent? 'Cause you can spend a lot of intense time with certain people, but it goes nowhere beyond that person.
Yeah.
Then
so it gave you a category of understanding these influencers. I've heard you talk about that book. So one time, one of Steph and I's favorite dates is back in the States is you would go to Barnes & Noble's or Borders Bookstore, and you know, they got the little coffee shop, and we'll go off and just get a pile of books and come back, and she'll read. It's so funny. She'll read all these books on child rearing, you know. Yeah. I'm like, with the kids all the time. Yeah. You want to come here and think about the kids some more? But she's got a pile of books on kids. And I go, and I just like, so after I heard you talk about the book, I grabbed it, and I read like the first couple of chapters there with a coffee, and they're really interesting. But now, hearing you say that, it makes me want to go back and read the whole thing, because I think I just kind of glossed over it. I didn't really, I didn't get to the point of impact in my life, so I need to go back and read that book, because that's good.
Well, let me mention just one more.
Sure.
And I want to hear one more from you.
Okay.
My favorite biography I've ever read, John Adams, David McCullough. Mm-hmm. And that book, it really shook me up. I mean, it really, really touched me. And it just, it brought out the life. It just showed how these men, how they stepped over the edge, knowing that in all likelihood they were going to be hanged, you know, by the British. But then just digging into John Adams' life and his dedication, his commitment to what he believed, it really touched me. And just looking now at the fruit of his life, you know, and I love good biographies. I feel like good biographies don't necessarily glorify. They don't glorify people. But they show how certain men and women profoundly influenced the world they lived in during their time, and how human history was changed because certain people lived with certain characteristics and made certain decisions. And John Adams was a big one for me on that. But okay, how about you? And then,
well, P.S. on John Adams, Caleb was asking, because I've told it by far it the top of my list of biographies, presidential biographies. And so I was looking, I loaned it to someone and I can't find it. Did I loan it to you?
No.
So Caleb wanted to read it the other day.
This, by the way, bothers me. Does it bother you? What? I go to look for a book on my shelf and I loaned it out to someone and they never brought it back.
Yeah. So I do have the DVD. I got, if you want to borrow that, I've got the DVD series. It's really good.
Really? Yeah, I'd love to see that.
And it's got a thing on there about David McAuliffe writing the book. I think you'd really enjoy that. Huh. Yeah, I'll let you borrow that. But, oh, man, that's such a great book. Books are like, you know, they're like old friends. You just say, oh, I haven't seen so-and-so in a long time. And then, oh, yeah, what a great guy. Yeah. So, you know, one theme I'm noticing here is all these books that have impacted us, none of these are Christian books. And I'm thinking, because I've got a list of books.
You've got Christian books, though, that influence you.
Well, I do. But I just pausing for a second and thinking, what's going on here? Why aren't believers writing books that are changing the world? I mean, there are books that believers are writing that are changing the subculture of Christianity.
Yeah.
But where are the books? And some of these others, we don't really know, but, you know, where they stand spiritually. But, I mean, I was thinking of, you know, another paradigm-changing book, David Kiersey, Please Understand Me. Mm-hmm. And that book shed a lot of light on, you know, understanding our psychological profiles. And you and I have talked about that before. But so I was thinking, what about the Christian? You know, what about a guy who loves Jesus and write a paradigm-changing book?
Yeah.
And for me, I'll have to say, you know, a classic would be Wild at Heart by John Eldredge. Uh-huh. And I think what Eldredge did was he spoke to a generation of polite Mr. Rogers, nice Christian boys, men, and gave them permission to be men. Hmm. So he had this really helpful framework of, you know, basically the masculine soul of an adventure to live, a battle to fight, and a beauty to rescue. And he just brilliantly wrote that, and so many men read that. And you kind of think, well, if I go into the church, I have to become more and more polite, more and more domesticated, more and more pale, more and more dull. You know, that's the end game for me as a man.
Yeah.
And he said, no, you know, you're going to be more and more masculine and live on a greater adventure and what he calls living in a larger story. So I think he's brilliant. And, you know, I listen to his podcast every week. And,
that paradigm has
shaped me a lot.
And so I see that in you, because when I meet with you, you know, you mentioned earlier you've transformed. For anybody who knows the Myers-Briggs, you've transformed from an ESTJ to an ESFJ.
Yes.
And I've seen that, and you're relentlessly exploring the matters of the heart, and I like that. That's one aspect of our friendship, you know, that I love, that I really treasure. Is you're always going after my heart. When the conversation is a little bit too out there, a little bit too spacey, you know, you're always wanting to bring it back. I'll tell you what, you know, when you mentioned the word, the name John Eldridge, what, and the message, you know, of course, of the book is obviously profound. But when I open the pages of his book, I'm just seeing excellent writing. Just the writing itself is so polished, and it just carries you.
Uh-huh.
And you know, we talk about Christian writers, and that's one thing I would love to see, is just that those of us who are followers of Jesus would write compelling literature, classic literature that's right up there, and just the way we write, the way we use words, the way we craft sentences, the way we portray ideas, would have ramifications and influence that just rocket, you know, far beyond the realm of churches and the Christian world, and truly touch the lives of millions of people. And there are some people out there that are doing that. But hey, this is we're running out of time here, so maybe we'll do a part two and
that
talk about
good.
Some more books next time.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe we could do another category. We've kind of talked about the paradigm shifters. What about books that have just motivated, that have just stirred you?
Yeah.
You read it and you just like felt like climbing a mountain afterwards.
Huh.
You know, what are the books that have just more at a more at an emotional level stirred you?
Talk about that.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. Good. Well, hey, thanks for this good conversation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. I found this very stimulating, and we hope you do too, reader. And we'd love to hear from you. If we've got this blog that's been a little neglected for the last couple of weeks, but we're going to try to post some more things. And I saw our Facebook fan page had zero posts, zero comments this week, zero. You know?
Well, that's our standard for next week. We just got to beat zero.
We've got to beat zero. So, you know, get on Facebook, Faith Activators, or Twitter. You know, but we'd love to hear from you. We've both posted articles, and it's really fun to hear from you. And or you can help us get the word out on this podcast. We appreciate you, dear reader, dear listener, rather, and hopefully a reader, too. You can read Paul's book, A Certain Risk, and it'll mess with your paradigm. And we pray God would bless you and stir you and just call you to great things, and you would really sense his calling in your life in with greater discernment. See you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye now.